And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California, and on the World Wide Web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. And today we have two guests, David Renzin and Chris Bojalian. And to help me interview our first guest, David Renzin, author of The Mailroom, I have a co-host, one of my best friends, actually, Glenn Goldstein. Glenn is former executive director and counsel for AFTRA and SAG in Philadelphia, and later an entertainment lawyer for 15 years in Philly. And now he is an L.A.-based broadcast talent manager. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, good afternoon.
Glenn was so appropriate here to help me interview our first guest, David Renzin, because of his background and because he's just kind of a fun guy. So David Renzin is the co-author of show business legend Bernie Brillstein's widely lauded memoir, When Did I Go Right?, as well as Olympian Louis Zamperini's World War II survival saga, Devil at My Heels. Renzin also co-wrote Tim Allen's number one bestseller, Don't Stand Too Close to a Naked Man, and his follow-up bestseller, I'm Not Really Here. Renzin has co-written bestsellers with Chris Rock, Jeff Foxworthy, and Gary Shandling, and co-authored a groundbreaking humorous anthology of men named Bob called The Bob Book. David Renzin's current book is The Mailroom, Hollywood History from the Bottom Up, published by Ballantine. Hi, David.
Hey, Barbara. Hey, Glenn.
Hi, how are you?
I'm right, Glenn. I hear the fun in your voice already.
So kind of you.
David, will you talk a bit about the theme of The Mailroom and how you found this idea, or did it find you?
Oh, well, you know, it's a little bit of both. The theme of The Mailroom is pretty much this. What is it like to start at the bottom in a classic Hollywood talent agency mailroom, dreaming of the top? And the Hollywood mailroom is, you know, really, it's the, when you say I started the mailroom, that it's not the IBM mailroom, it's the Hollywood mailroom. It's part of our cultural lexicon. It's the place where the American dream takes shape, you know, in a town of the American dream. So, you know, and it happens to be where most of the people who run Hollywood started, or a lot of them anyway, David Geffen, Barry Diller, Mike Ovitz, all the guys who run the talent agencies these days, guys who are big managers like Bernie Brillstein, whose book I wrote, the guys who manage Seinfeld, director, producers like Irwin Winkler. I mean, even a California State Congressman, Kevin Murray, started there, and James Van Prague, who is a famous medium for the dearly departed. So how did it find me, or how did I find it? Actually, I was writing Bernie's book, and he started in the mailroom, and he had quite a class, so to speak, of people who were with him. And I said, wow. And he said, yeah. And we made a list, and when we were done with his book, fortunately, it was widely lauded, so I had like some access. And I just went out and said, you know, the best reason, of course, was that no one ever did it. So I went and I did an oral history of what it was like. I interviewed 250 people over 2 years, and the result is sort of a primer on how to get ahead in any business for anybody.
So one thing I'm interested in, as I understand it, starting out in the mailroom at an agency means that you make a pittance, probably far less than you would make if you got another kind of job using your education. Why are folks willing to do this?
Well, just look at the other end of the rainbow. There's a pot of gold, as one of the guys said. You know, everybody wants to be in show business. We all have two businesses, our own and show business. People want to be in the movies. That's why we watch Entertainment Tonight or Entertainment Weekly, why, you know, stars are used to sell magazines. So sometimes in the beginning it was just streetwise kids from Brooklyn, you know, who were just getting a better life by, you know, working in Manhattan and the glamour of rubbing shoulders with celebrities. Maybe they delivered it, you know, to Judy Garland or Marilyn Monroe. Later it became, you know, when Mike Ovitz made agents quote-unquote respectable and it was big money and he was on the cover of Fortune and Forbes, and all of a sudden people said, well, you know, so what if I became a lawyer? I can really make big money in Hollywood. And, you know, you can't just start at the top, so if they're young and ambitious, they start at the bottom of the ambition factory. They make a couple hundred bucks a week, but if they got what it takes, you know, they're out of there, they're working for an agent after that, then they're an agent themselves, and then perhaps they stay and perhaps they leave to become a manager or a producer or whatever.
Yeah.
David, I was interested reading the book, just to ask you a couple questions. How did you gain access to the people? Was that because of the relationship you had with Bernie Brillstein?
In part it was. I mean, I've been working in Hollywood, you know, writing, doing Playboy interviews for 20-something years.
Yes.
And before that, working for Rolling Stone and the music magazines. So, you know, I know how to get access. And then, of course, you know, the fact that Bernie's book was, you know, really well-received, and he has a lot of friends.
Right.
That helped. In
terms of getting people to open up, you know, I was very impressed how people really were revealing of embarrassing moments or revelatory moments. Could you describe getting people to open up? How do you put them at ease? How do you get them to tell these stories?
Well, you know, in a way, it's just part of who I am, which may sound weird, but, you know, if you find you have a facility for something, people just talk to me. Okay, but of course I've learned how to make them just talk to me. As far as them opening up, you know, they're considering that usually they're very closed-mouthed if they're agents or producers or managers, because people only want to talk about their current clients and how much money they're making. This was a sort of a breath of fresh air. They got to go back and remember this sort of, you know, boot camp that they came out of, and they are sort of like the few, the proud, the Marines. So they were happy. Because, you know, that's the thing they all talk about. If you've been through the mailroom, when you get together, eventually the subject comes up. Ah, remember the time, this, that. There's classic mailroom stories. You know, I just tapped a vein that was waiting.
And then, David, what did you do with all of that material? I mean, I imagine you had much more material than you used.
Well, the book is 165,000 words. It used to be 310,000 words. But the idea was to be able to pick it up with one hand.
So how did you cut? What did you decide? How did you decide what to cut?
Well, you know, it's intuitive. But I think what I did is I looked at all the quotes, because it is an oral history in their voice. I squeezed the air out of the quotes to make it very succinct. Each word had to count. And then I just took, you know, stories that were vaguely duplicates, you know, or said the same thing, just a different person, and picked the best of the stories that, you know, that moved the story forward. And I had a really good editor, so.
Hmm. If you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here with David Renzin, author of The Mailroom, Hollywood History from the Bottom Up, and my co-host, Glenn Goldstein. And I should say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my co-host and my guest, and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents.
Am I making it sound too easy?
No. It was fascinating how the experience of being in the mailroom was consistent through the decades, and you organized the material partially chronologically. And, you know, would you agree with that, David, that notwithstanding the passage of time, notwithstanding how much Hollywood has changed, the fundamental experience of being in the mailroom, of doing what was necessary at any moment, really has been consistent?
That's right, exactly. And that was the thing that I wanted to show, that, you know, even though, you know, that we went from teletype machines to high-speed computers and, you know, et cetera, it's still the same experience. And you asked me earlier how I got access. There was one other way, and that is whenever I talked to someone, they always knew someone who had been in their class, since they all keep in touch. And they go, well, you got to talk to this person.
Did you find there were people who would not talk?
Very few.
And you did get, I know, the notoriously press-shy David Geffen.
He talked. Yeah.
And in the book, I thought that was one of the most provocative episodes, if you will, just for the listeners, there had been a requirement at the time that you had to be a college graduate to get into the mailroom. Is that correct?
That's right. And well, no, not at David's time. But the only requirement was if you say you went to college, you better not be lying.
Okay, so he didn't have to have been, but it was on his resume.
That's right. He made his resume look good. He lied. He got in. A week later, somebody in his mailroom got fired. He asked why. They said, I lied about my college experience. Geffen, who loved his job, got scared. He made up some stationery from CBS and from the University of California in Los Angeles and went into the mailroom every morning at 6 a.m. for 6 months waiting for those letters that say he lied to come in. When they did, he steamed open the envelopes, put his letters in, and sent them on and stayed.
And stayed. And yet, here's a gentleman who has accomplished so much, but who early in his career
did what he had to do to keep the job.
Right. And he seemed to me in the book to be rather cavalier about the whole thing.
I don't know if I'd use the word cavalier, although I can see why you would use it. He was just sort of matter of fact. Is that the same?
Yeah. Touche.
You know, exactly. He was just, he just felt that's what he had to do. I mean, in the scheme of things, it's not Jason Blair, you know?
Touche. Is the mailroom today as effective a breeding ground as it was in the heyday?
I think yes, partly, but partly it is sort of going the way of the teletype machine. There will still, I think, be entry positions, and they will work in a mailroom. But, you know, a lot of the driving adventures that are in the book, and, you know, I will say that there are, and you probably, I hope you agree, that there's a laugh or a lesson on every single page.
Yes, absolutely.
And you know, there's a lot of adventures about driving around town. Those are gone because they outsource that stuff. And, of course, you can't really read the inner office envelopes because they're now on email.
but unless you're a hacker.
You know, essentially it's the same.
Now, I'm curious in how you see this book as helping, how it can help people breaking in. Who want to break into Hollywood? Who want to, you know, kind of work their way in?
Well, I think you know, it not only helps you if you want to break into Hollywood, but if you want to break in anywhere. I think people have generally, after coming out of college, you know, even though it's a lot of hard work to get your degree and your law degree or whatever, they don't really have any idea about the real world. And the real world is a bunch of people who, you know, do what they can to get ahead, and you have to, you know, you have to be acquainted with it. Also, you have to be the right kind of person who can take it. As you see in the book, there are so many opportunities for people to just quit and go, I can't stand this, but then where would they be, right?
Mm. Well, I read it as a cautionary tale in many ways.
Yes.
That this is not glamorous, that this is hard work, and that if your spirit is easily broken, it will be broken.
Well, that's true. On the other hand, you could always deliver packages to Sharon Stone.
Indeed. Would you like to, just for the listeners, would you like to detail that story? Would you mind?
That before Sharon was a big star, this one guy in the CAA mailroom, you know, and he was flirting with her and she with him, and one day he was asked to take a package over there and come back in 7 minutes. He came back 40 minutes later, but unfortunately for him, those 40 minutes later, 40 minutes were spent with Sharon in a bathrobe. They were drinking tea. He was deciding, should I go for it or not, and he didn't. And later he found out he should have.
To his eternal regret, right.
Talking about just sort of the process, the writing process a bit, I'm wondering, you mentioned earlier, you know, when we were talking about getting people to open up, that you have a background as, you know, writing for various magazines, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about that, how that background is in journalism or, you know, for magazines may have helped you with this book.
Well, I mean, a couple things, I guess. First of all, you know, I discovered pretty early on while I was in journalism at magazines that I was the kind of guy who liked not only to talk to people but liked to write what they had to say. Because rather than turn in a stories that have paragraphs of description and analysis and a substantiating quote, I turned in one line of setup and three quotes, and my editors went crazy. So I realized, you know, what I was about. And I'm interested, and I listen. Larry King once told me, you know, the worst thing about interviewing when he's been interviewed is that, you know, somebody comes in with five questions, he'll say something provocative that demands a follow-up in the first answer, and they ignore it.
Mm.
So I listen, and I just, you know, I'm a collaborative kind of guy, so I learned over 30 years just what I'm good at and how to do it and, you know, when to lean forward and for intimacy, when to lean back to give them space, when to drop in the question about do you wear boxers or jockeys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that led to the books I started to do because what I really am good at, I think, is just getting other people's voices right. And so, a number of the people you mentioned at the beginning all told me, you know, their books sound like them.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that? Does it come back to listening again, or do you have techniques where you got this down?
No, you know, I apologize in advance, but whatever technique I have is part of me now. I just have a sense. And I mean, I can say that if you keep at it long enough and you do well, you will develop, it'll become second nature. But yeah, I mean, I listen. I never change anybody's meaning, although I might change a word or two, which usually leads them to say, thank you for making me sound smarter. But, you know, their meanings are always very clear, and it's, you know, 99% exactly what they said and how they said it. But, you know, I got a lot of training in the Playboy interview, which, you know, used to take hours and hours and hours over days and weeks. And then what you would do is you take this 400 or 500-page transcript, and you'd literally have to cut it into a film on paper. It would start in a logical place, have, you know, dynamics all the way through and end in a logical place, although it may not have borne any resemblance to the conversation that actually took place. So you become like a film editor. So that helped me.
Mm-hmm.
Do any of those Playboy interviews stand out in your mind as particularly difficult or gratifying?
Well, as I'm in the fortunate position of having been able to interview who I want, they pretty much are all gratifying, and for different reasons.
Right.
You know, Bill Gates was gratifying because, you know, when he put his hand on his mouth and blew a raspberry at something I said, I got to blow it back.
Right.
And Gary Shandling was like fencing, you know, with him, but in this sort of affectionate way.
Because he was very guarded?
Well, Gary, yeah. Well, that he didn't take his sunglasses off the whole time.
There you go.
But he's just a way of, he would put you down, and then you'd have to put him down back in a way that actually put him down, but at the same time showed you respected him.
Right. That very fine line.
Yeah. I don't know. I just, you know, I really think that what Bernie Brillstein once told me is that you really have to try what you want to try, and you have to see if your instincts are good. I mean, that's really what it's about. And if they are, you know, if you're in show business or whatever business and you know, you say, hey, I think this is going to be great or this is going to be a hit or whatever, and you're right, then you know you're in the right place.
Yeah. You are listening to Writers on Writing. We're here today with David Renzin, author of The Mailroom, Hollywood History from the Bottom Up, published by Ballantine. I'm Barbara DeMarco-Bear, and I'm here with Glenn Goldstein.
David, another thing that struck me while reading your book, Hollywood is always described as a place that is fraught with nepotism. And it seemed to me, reading the book, that in many ways that was true.
Yes, it is, sure. You know, if your dad is head of programming at CBS, you probably, you know, get an entry-level job if that's what you want to do.
And yet, in the mailroom, they were not treated preferentially or deferentially.
That's right. Well, you took the words out of my mouth. Yeah, exactly. You can get in, but if you don't have what it takes, goodbye.
That's right. So in that way, the mailroom is the great equalizer.
That's right, because you can be a steelworker's son from Portage, Indiana,
right,
or an insurance salesman's daughter, and if you have it, you can, you know, you get, it's literally a test from the day you ask for the job. And it's all about service.
What kind of money do they make today? One of the things that struck me over and over again in the book is just how bad the wages were. Almost like that was part of the program, not just to save money by the agency, but to really flush people out. Do you have a feel for that?
I honestly don't really, because I didn't ask them how much they made. I mean, I know what they made in the mailroom.
Yes.
And I know at some point a guy thought, now that I'm an assistant, I'm making big money. I mean, there's one scene in there where a guy says, oh, really, what are you making? He says, yeah, $32,500. And this is a guy who, you know, the guy was asking was a lawyer who'd just given up like a $150,000 a year job to come out and to be in the mailroom. And he was astounded. But on the other hand, you know, make partner in an agency or whatever other business, and the money can be fabulous.
Hmm.
And the power.
Did you know what you were going to find when you started this book?
No.
What did you come out of it learning yourself?
That I'm sure is heck glad I'm not in the mailroom. No, I never go into any project having any idea what I'm going to find. That's part of why I do it, because I like the ride. It makes it very difficult to write book proposals because they literally want you to know in advance what they're getting. you know, so you do some preliminary stuff. But even in the mailroom, I mean, the stuff I wrote to sell the book was terrific, but after a month of doing the book, you know, I had even more terrific stuff.
Hmm. How does that work then with your editor in terms of as the proposal, you know, spells out what it's going to be, and as you go along in the project and it starts perhaps adjusting itself a bit?
As long as it adjusts itself better, you're mm-hmm. not in any trouble.
Mm-hmm.
but you should have a relationship with your editor and be able to, you know, talk to your editor about all these things and compensate. I know that my original structure wasn't what the book is now, but like I said, people kept referring me to people they'd worked with, so I ended up having actual classes, using the term loosely, of people throughout 65 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually never talked to them about it because I could tell it was working.
Right.
And that's really what they want. I think proposals are, and I mean, I only have limited, you know, a limited experience in this because of the kinds of books I do, but I think proposals are, A, to see if you have your head in order, to, you know, give them some idea what you're getting, and in case you really don't give them what you promised, they can always cancel your book. They have a leg to stand on.
Right. So in terms of the proposal then, obviously you did sell the book using a proposal.
Yeah.
And what was your experience with, did you use an agent, literary agent?
Yeah, yeah. I have a literary agent, and I was working, it's an interesting story, I was working on another book proposal at the time, and I was feeling sort of down and wanted to have a pat on the back, so I called him up and I said, and this illustrates agent relationships, I said, hey, did I ever tell you about my idea about the mailroom? And I figured he'd go, oh, great idea. Well, you're a great guy. Go back to work. But what he said was, no, you haven't, and if I was you, I'd drop what I was doing and go do that book. And so I did, and it serves me right. He saw it. He saw what the book was before I saw what the book was. I had a great idea, but I hadn't done the work. And as I went out and did the work, and believe me, for the 2.5 years I did the work, my wife will tell you, you know, how many times I said, what is this book? I don't get it. I didn't know, you know. But I relied on sort of automatic skills and just, you know, I don't give up. I persevered, just like you have to in the mailroom, I guess. And what I came out with was greater than the sum of its parts. Surprised me, which is always a good thing.
So it was 2.5 years in the making?
Yeah.
Wow. How do you sustain yourself in writing a book over that period of time?
You mean, do I exercise?
No. No, I mean, gosh, you know, it seems so far off to, you know.
Think about it. I don't know how long it's going to take.
Mm-hmm.
I just, somebody once said, I think it was E.L. Doctorow, and I pardon if I'm wrong. He says, writing a book is like driving between L.A. and New York at night. All you see is what's in the headlights, but you're on the road and you eventually get there.
Mm-hmm.
I'll ask another question in terms of the content of the book. It seemed to me that a certain measure of ruthlessness, and I'm not trying to be trite, I'm just making observations, but a certain amount of ruthlessness was inbred in the mailroom for future success at the agencies. Again, am I getting that correctly, David, or would you feel that it wasn't quite that bad?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of cliches about Hollywood, and probably most of them are true, which is why they're cliches. But I think that what's inbred is servitude. You work in the mailroom to service the agency. You work as an agent's assistant to service the agent, and it's all in the service of becoming an agent and, you know, dealing with the egos of clients and getting them jobs. And it's the same as if you're a manager or producer. The client is always, the talent is king. So,
and yet at the same time, they would step over each other to advance their own careers.
Absolutely.
There were innumerable instances, right? I mean, innumerable, where people would say, yeah, that guy left and that was wonderful.
But I think it's that way in other businesses as well. And but it's just never as high profile. That's why, you know, I did the Hollywood mailroom and not, you know, Joe's Dairy mailroom.
Yeah.
Because the stories here are better. It's, you know, like I say, the confluence of a couple of versions of the American dream. So, yeah, they're ruthless. But by and large, agents aren't stereotypical. They're nice guys. They're out there to get you a job. You know, they want to have the best clients and get the best jobs because he who controls the talent is king.
Yeah. We are unfortunately out of time. The time has flown. I want to thank you for coming on, for taking the time to come on the show.
Hey, yeah, I thought we just started.
And thank you, Glenn.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, David.
Good questions, Glenn and Barbara. I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
That was David Renzin, author of The Mailroom, Hollywood History from the Bottom Up, published by Ballantine, and he's speaking to us from L.A. Do stay tuned. We'll be back with Chris Bajalian, author of The Buffalo Soldier. Don't go away. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We're back, and we have Chris Bajalian on. He is author of 8 novels, including Trans Sister Radio, The Law of Similars, Midwives, which was a number one New York Times bestseller, an Oprah's Book Club selection, a Publisher's Weekly Best Book, and a New England Booksellers Association Discovery selection, and most recently, The Buffalo Soldier. In 2002, he won the New England Book Award. His work has been published in 17 languages and 20 countries, and 2 of his novels, Midwives and Past the Bleachers, have been made into TV movies. Both The Buffalo Soldier and Trans Sister Radio are currently in development. Chris Bajalian has written for many magazines, including Reader's Digest, Cosmopolitan, and the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine. He lives in Vermont with his wife and young daughter. Hi, Chris.
How are you?
Great. Great to have you on.
Well, thanks for chatting with me.
Well, I love this book. I love The Buffalo Soldier. I love Midwives, and didn't have time to read the others, and now I must.
It's okay. There will never be a Blue Book exam on them, I promise.
Well, you know, it's just that you have this, of course, you have a certain style and tone, and the way you use language is all very mesmerizing, and it seems, you know, The Midwives and The Buffalo Soldier was very definitely written by the same writer, and if you like the writer, you want to read everything.
Well, thank you.
It's kind of the place I'm at with your books right now, but will you talk about The Buffalo Soldier in particular and how the book came about?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I know precisely when the book was inspired. The book was inspired on June 28, 1998. When after 4 weeks of rain and 4 inches in an hour, this usually lazy, meandering river in my little village overflowed its banks. It carved 40-foot chasms in the adjacent paved road, obliterated all of the nearby dirt roads, of which we have many, and it washed away a pair of steel and cement bridges that had stood for 70 years. The next day, when I was walking around Lincoln, I was struck by the enormity of the damage, but also how fortunate we were that if the water was going to crest in this cataclysmic a fashion, it crested in the middle of the night, and rather than in the middle of the day, when inevitably there would have been children on those bridges or on the banks of the river. And I thought to myself, what if, and I began a book that was going to be essentially a he-said, she-said meditation on grief in which a village loses almost everything in exactly that kind of flood, and one couple lose everything in their twin daughters, and a father and a daughter would narrate what this cataclysmic loss felt like to them. And that essentially might have been the book, and it might have been a pretty relentlessly dark book, except for the fact about 6 months after this flood, my daughter came home from kindergarten, and she had her class picture, and the class picture was adorable. There were 15 kids in it, but what struck me wasn't that here are 15 adorable five-year-olds, but rather that they were all white. Now, there are many things I cherish about Vermont, but its racial homogeneity is not among them.
Yeah.
And I began to wonder what would happen if, for example, my Asian-American niece in New York City or my Asian-American nephew were suddenly and unceremoniously dropped into my daughter's all-white kindergarten class, or a Latino child, or an African-American child. And suddenly I had a brand new character, a 10-year-old African-American foster child named Alfred, who would serve as the fulcrum around which all the events in the novel would spin. And the discovery of Alfred was one of the great gifts I had with my writing ever, and certainly the greatest gift I had with this particular novel, because all of a sudden, I had somebody to lift me and the reader away from this endless despair that would engulf any parent who's lost 2 children.
So the novel began with the flood,
yep.
And then Alfred came into it.
Yep.
And then at what point did the couple come into it with problems?
Do you mean
Laura and Terry?
The foster parents' marital problems?
Uh-huh.
You know, when I was researching loss, one of the things that struck me was how many marriages go to hell in a handbasket when a child dies.
Yeah.
You know, certainly some marriages are strengthened and some people grow even tighter. But the reality is that a whole lot of marriages dissipate in the wake of this sort of loss. And so Terry and Laura, they are Alfred, this foster child's foster parents. Their marriage has been not exactly hemorrhaging since their daughters died, but it's been ailing. It's been getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And while Laura, the foster mother, sees in Alfred this wonderful opportunity to, you know, to love once again and to sort of climb out of this shell in which she's been living, Terry simply sees this little child who isn't his daughter, who isn't either of his daughters, and with whom he doesn't have the relationship that he had built with Hillary and Megan, his daughters, which causes the marriage to finally begin to start hemorrhaging. My characters are sort of like a litter of kittens. I never know quite where they're going. And while I knew that this marriage was in trouble, and I'm not ruining anything for listeners or for readers with what I'm about to say, you know, I had no idea about 60 or 70 pages into the novel that Terry would start having an extramarital affair with this woman he meets not far from Deer Camp. That surprised the heck out of me. I think it surprised the heck out of him. I think he thought he was just, you know, flirting a little bit. And, well, one thing led to another, and, you know, suddenly they were tumbling together in her friend's trailer.
So is that how things happen in your books? You start with a basic idea and then see what happens? Or how much do you know? How much plotting do you do?
I do little plotting. John Irving has said that you should never write the first sentence of a novel until you can write the last sentence of the novel, which might be why, you know, if I'm stranded on a desert island, I want a bookshelf of John Irving's books. But the reality is that that has never been my modus operandi. I've never had any notion with any of my books how they're going to end when I began them. And speaking selfishly, that certainly made the writing process infinitely more enjoyable for me. I have no idea if the story I'm about to tell you is true or not, but I've heard it in a number of places, and I just love it. Supposedly, Mary McCarthy was once returning to New York City from Europe, and she had a steamer trunk lost that had the typed first draft and her notes for a novel. And this was the era of carbon paper, and she hadn't been using carbon paper. And so she was convinced that this novel was absolutely gone. She would never see it again. And so her friends were commiserating with her. And finally, at a cocktail party, this man said to Mary McCarthy, "You know, I'm really, really sorry for your loss, but, well, for crying out loud, why don't you just start rewriting the novel right now while it's still fresh in your mind?" And she thought about this for a moment and then said, "Huh, you know, I could never do that because I know how it's going to end." The steamer truck did materialize about a week later. But that's how I feel about my books. Because I don't know where they're going, writing is just massive amounts of fun for me. I start writing about 5 a.m. in the morning, and it's a good barometer for me whether a book is worth pursuing. If it is so exciting to me that I can't wait to start writing, if it has gotten to the point where I want to sleep in a little bit, where, you know, I want to answer emails at 5 a.m. before getting to the book, then that's a pretty good indication that the book is either in trouble or it's insufficiently interesting to me. And if it's not interesting enough for me to write it, then heaven knows it won't be interesting enough for a reader to want to read it.
So if you find yourself in that situation where you're at 5 a.m. answering emails and you find you've become a little bored, what do you do? What happens with the writing?
Twice in the last 5 years, I've scrapped novels.
Hmm. How far in have you been?
Once I was about 70 pages, and once I was about 240.
Hmm.
But the book, I'd simply lost my enthusiasm for the book. And while I think I'm enough of a professional that if I had to finish the book, I certainly could have. But I question whether the book would have been my best work, and I certainly question whether it would have been the kind of book that I would feel good about a reader investing 3, 4, 5, you know, 6, 7 days of his or her life with.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is Chris Bajalian, author of The Buffalo Soldier. I've noticed in your work that weather and landscape are very much a presence, almost like another character, and I wonder if that's a conscious effort.
You know, it didn't begin as a conscious effort, but it has become a conscious effort. Specifically, I've now lived in Vermont for 16 and a half years. I grew up in New York City and around New York City in suburbs, and weather isn't critical in Westchester County. When you think of New York City, the first thing you think, the first thing you don't think about the weather first. In Vermont, however, weather is critical to all that we do. It's not simply that, for example, this February, we had 8 consecutive days where I live where it did not go above zero, or 11 days when it did not go above 32, or that 2 years ago we had so much snow that the snow drifts were so high, and I have a 3-story house, so high against the northern wall that you couldn't see out the first floor windows in the living room and the dining room. Weather matters in mud season, and it matters in the summer when the days are glorious and long. We really cherish the weather here in the summer because, you know, some years we've only got about 5 weeks of it, so every day is precious. We're not exactly slaves to weather, certainly not in the 21st century, but I find it interesting that I spent the day with this elderly neighbor just last week. As recently as 1944, the village in which I lived had no electricity. Most people didn't have running water, and the mail, on 4 or 5 months a year, either because of snow or mud, the mail just stopped at the end of the road 3 miles away. So weather is indeed a character in my books, if only because so much of what we do revolves around it.
Yeah. I'm very curious about something else that happens in this book, and that is that all of your dialogue is not held within quotes.
Yes.
Quote marks. Will you talk about that, why you did
sure.
it that way?
You're a very observant reader. Thank you for noticing that. My most recent books, Water Witches, Midwives, Law of Similars, Transistor Radio, were all first-person novels. They all had idiosyncratic narrators, Connie Danforth, the midwife's daughter in Midwives, or Dana Stevens, the tenured university professor in transsexual and transistor radio. And The Buffalo Soldier, like them, began as a first-person novel, narrated by Terry Sheldon, the grieving father, and Laura Sheldon, the grieving mother. And I was enjoying this first writing in their first-person voices, but Alfred entered the book, and so he had his first-person chapters. Listeners who've read the book know that there are these other characters, Phoebe Danvers, the woman with whom Terry has an affair, Paul and Emily Hebert, the older couple across the street who take these wounded people under their wing. They had their chapters, and so suddenly I had 6 different first-person narrators jockeying for a position, and it was becoming an unruly, cacophonic mess. So I took a step back and said, maybe this needs to be more of a Jamesian third-person novel. But I haven't written a third-person novel since Hangman, my second novel, way back in 1990. And I wanted to make sure that even though I was moving into the third person, all of these characters, especially when they were speaking, retained their idiosyncratic tics, their vocal mannerisms, so that you never confused Laura Sheldon's voice with Phoebe Danvers' voice, or you never confused Terry Sheldon with Paul Hebert, the adult men in the novel. And so as an exercise for myself, I wrote without quote marks so that I could just pick up a page of the manuscript and know instantly, and see if I could tell instantly who was speaking, so their voices remained distinct. And then when I had about 300 or 400 pages, I don't know how many, I planned to put the quote marks back in. But I liked how it felt without them. It felt like a stream of consciousness to me, and so I decided to not add the quote marks in after all. But it literally began as nothing more than a writerly challenge to make sure that the voices remained distinct.
Yeah, I really like that very much. It felt, more what? Dreamlike, more natural, more like...
I hope it feels dreamlike. Thank you for that.
Yeah, really. I love that about it. I was also wondering, because your books are very emotional, and The Buffalo Soldier had so many emotional peaks in it, that I began to wonder how much of you was in that book, or and if you drew upon painful moments that you or people that you know have been through, or if you just made it up, if somehow you found all of this within you and just made it up.
The reality is that, yes, I did make it all up. That point notwithstanding, there are bits of autobiographic minutiae scattered throughout this novel, as there are in most of my books. Specifically in The Buffalo Soldier, however, the autobiographic minutiae is less likely to appear in Terry and Laura's sections than it is in Alfred's sections. I was never a foster child, but we moved a lot when I was growing up. The joke in the family is that one of my parents was wanted by the law. I once counted it up for my daughter, but I went to 8 different public schools, including 4 different public schools in 4 consecutive years at one point. So I was always that new kid on the block with his fingers pressed up against the glass, wondering why he wasn't invited to the party, or if they needed a 10th for basketball, why in the name of heaven did no one call me? And there are a few scenes from Alfred's perspective that were pulled whole cloth from my childhood, including one particular scene when Alfred is in the back seat of the car and they're on their way to Terry's mother's house for Thanksgiving, and he sees a lot of kids playing ball,
yeah.
And he wonders why he wasn't invited, and he wonders whether his foster parents think he's this incredible loser because no one called him.
Hmm.
I'll also tell you that whenever I was focusing on the scenes of Terry and Laura's grief at the loss of their twin daughters, I would just race out to the school bus. My daughter was in kindergarten and first grade when I was writing this book, and just race out to the school bus to hug her when she would get off the bus. As any parent, I think it's very hard to plumb some of that territory.
Yeah, I would imagine as a parent that would be some of the most difficult work in this book.
Yep.
As I was reading it, and I have an 8-year-old, and I was thinking, now how did he do this?
Yeah. You know, and the hardest part wasn't actually their death scene, which is the prologue. The hardest part were the scenes later on into the book when Terry is alone and Laura's alone and they're just, you know, looking at pictures, or just a memory will catch them, or Terry at one point sees, you know, one of his daughters in his wife's eyes, you know, in the shape of her eyes,
yes,
and the shape of her chin. And those were the most difficult scenes to write.
Hmm. There's quite a surprise at the ending, and I'm not going to go into it, but was that a surprise to you too? You know, there's sort,
yeah,
of a circling to the beginning, and then one of your characters does something quite surprising with a character who's most,
yeah,
unlikely. That must have been just, you know, I'm being so cryptic here, but I must, listeners, because you must read this book. Was that a major surprise to you?
Yes, this was a very messy book. Basically, you've got 3 grown-ups in Terry and Laura and Phoebe, the woman with whom Terry's having an affair. You've got this elderly couple across the street in Paul and Emily. And you've got this little boy who I really, really loved, Alfred. And there's all kinds of messiness among these 6 people in their relationships and what they know about each other and what they don't know about each other. And I really was hoping that this book would have a happy ending, but I wasn't sure it was going to. And my books don't always have happy endings.
Mm.
Certainly the Law of Similars. I don't think I go a week without readers writing me about the ending of Transistor Radio or The Law of Similars. And those books came out a couple of years ago now, wanting to know if there will ever be a sequel, because the ending was just so messy and disconcerting for them, and they wanted to know more, and they wanted to know where it was going. Now, The Buffalo Soldier, I finished at a very precise moment in time, and that was immediately before 9/11.
Mm.
So I was going through the page proofs and the galley in the fall of 2001. The hardcover came out in the spring of 2002, the paperback, of course, a few months ago in the spring of 2003. And that affected the ending. Without wanting to give the ending away, I will tell you that I was certainly in a state of mind in the fall of 2001 where I couldn't bear to have Laura and Terry endure any more pain than they had already endured.
Right. Well, it was quite a wonderful ending. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Chris Bojalian, author of The Buffalo Soldier. I wonder if getting back to the writing process, if you have any sort of, rituals or actions or anything you do that get you into the writing mode at 5 a.m.
Yes, I'm pretty obsessive compulsive. First of all, I always begin by rewriting the last paragraph or two paragraphs or even page that I wrote the day before. And that's something that Hemingway recommended that I just think is wonderful, because you immediately get reacquainted with the story. You are editing, and the more you edit, I think the better the book is going to be, and it works as a runway. You literally ramp up to speed to get going. And while I don't know precisely what's going to happen in that scene, I don't know exactly what my characters are going to do, before I fall asleep every night, and this is how I fall asleep, I'm thinking about what I'm going to be writing the next day. For example, let's suppose it's midwives. I know that the next scene is going to be Sybil Danforth watching the jury chosen. I don't know what's going to happen in the courtroom, but I consciously fall asleep thinking about the courtroom, what it looks like, what Sybil might be experiencing. In the case of the Buffalo Soldier, I might know that, I know that tomorrow I'm going to be writing a scene where Terry and Alfred are going to be working on some home improvement on their house in Vermont, and is it going to be a scene in which Terry and Alfred will bond, or a scene in which they'll grow further apart? And I won't know that, but I will be thinking about it as I fall asleep. I do have to have a perfectly feng shui ordered library. I have to have everything in its place when I start working. There can't be papers on this wonderful 150-year-old pumpkin pine dining room table that serves as a table on which I write. See, I'm pretty compulsive.
That sounds good to me. We have a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask you if there's anything... Well, I'll save that question if we have any time, but I wanted to know about your research in terms of... It sounds like you started the book without really knowing much about foster care until you were into the book.
That's right.
At that point, is that where you start doing research, when you're into something and you know this is going to carry you and you're going to stay with it, and now it's time to find out about it?
In this book's case, yes. That's one of the great advantages to living in a tiny state like Vermont. We've only got about 650,000 people in the whole bloody state. The capital is 15,000 people. That's it. So it's really easy to pick up the phone and call the head of the Agency of Human Services for the whole state of Vermont, asked to buy him lunch, and he will say, sure, great, let's have a bite to eat. And so through him, I met social workers, and through the social workers, I met very specifically multiracial foster families in Vermont so that I could spend some time with them. That was the process. And it's wonderful, and that's something you can do in a tiny state like Vermont. Some of those stories were incredibly poignant because we are, alas, so bloody lily white. I had one mother tell me that she has a white daughter and a black son, and her white daughter gets her hair done at the village hairdresser in their village in about 40 miles from Burlington. But the first time she took her 7-year-old son to the barber in the village, she said, I'm sorry, I don't know how to cut his hair. I've never cut an African-American child's hair. She ended up having to drive to Burlington to find a barber who could do her son's hair. And she said to me, what message am I sending to my son that his sister gets her hair cut about a mile from our house, but I have to drive him 40 miles away into Burlington?
Yeah.
And I heard those stories all the time. I wouldn't have learned that if I hadn't done the research, if I hadn't done my homework. Now, midwives, I didn't write a word of midwives until I'd spent about 6 months researching the place, literal and metaphoric place of birth in our country. Fortunately, as Pocahontas says in the Disney movie, I knew enough to know how little I knew, or whatever that expression is. And so I spent 6 months with midwives and moms and dads who'd had their babies at home before I wrote one word of that particular novel. And then I continued to research it as I was writing it, spending time with midwives and OBs and the medical examiner for the state of Vermont, so I could know, thank you very much, exactly how much blood would be in the peritoneal cavity of a woman who dies in that fashion.
Yeah, it was so specific. Oh, my
gosh.
Oh, we have another minute left. I'm curious if you prefer third person, as you wrote The Buffalo Soldier in, or first person of, say, midwives? Or does it just depend on the project?
It's a great question. And I'm not avoiding the question, but one of my favorite novels I've read over the last few months is Atonement. And I think one of the reasons why I loved it is because it's all, you know, third person, James and omniscient, and then you get to this incredible first person ending. And I felt I had the best of both worlds. I had this surprising narrator at the end to pull the rug out from under me, and I had you know, this wonderful, omniscient, authorial hand walking me through the first 300 pages.
Yeah.
I enjoyed writing midwives a lot because I cared so deeply about Connie and Sybil. But I enjoyed The Buffalo Soldier, too. And I hope it didn't feel I hope it did not feel too distant.
It didn't feel distant at all.
Good. Well, thank you.
I so appreciate you coming on. I wish we had more time. Please come back with your next book.
In a heartbeat, I will. Thank you for all that you do to support books. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. That was Chris Bajalian, author of The Buffalo Soldier. Quite a wonderful book. I wish I hadn't read it so I could read it again. And can't wait to read his other stuff other than Midwives, which I also love. So I'm glad there's a few other novels out there of his that I can pick up tomorrow. He was speaking to us from Lincoln, Vermont. If you have comments or questions or would like to know about future guests and events in the area, visit my website at writersonwriting.com. There you can sign to be on the mailing list. I will leave you with a quote by George Sand, who said, "The profession of writing is nothing else but a violent, indestructible passion. When it has once entered people's heads, it never leaves them." I want to thank again Glenn Goldstein for being with me today, our first guest, David Renzin, and again Chris Bajalian, author of The Buffalo Soldier. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you for listening.